Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today, I just said I wasn't going to pronounce it, but I'm going to try and pronounce your name, is Dan Chasen. Is
that correct, right? Graham? Perfect. 10 out of 10. And
we are here to talk about, a couple of things. I got interested in this work that you're currently doing because you wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books.
Right.
About Mom Donnie and the connections to Mom Donnie socialism and Bernie socialism. And then I just say Bernie Sanders, although I think everyone in the world is on a first name basis with Bernie
at this point.
And it turns out you're writing a book, which we're actually speaking on the 31st. I hadn't noticed that. So we're speaking in 2025, but you wrote a book that is about Bernie Sanders in Burlington, and that I'll publish this episode around the time that book is coming out. So we're here to talk about Mom Donnie socialism, Bernie socialism, what socialism means in 2026, as long as it doesn't mean what it meant in that. I mean, you and I both remember the 20th century when socialism was just
A bummer.
The worst thing.
Stale cheese and
lemons. And then I guess to continue my introduction of you, which I said I wasn't going to do, is you are a poet and a poet critic. And this is, if I have this right, your first book of non-poetry. So how did you come to write this book about Bernie for Burlington?
Yeah, thanks, Graham. It is, in fact, my first book that doesn't have as much to do with poetry, though there's poetry in it. And in fact, that's part of the book's argument that everything happening in the culture is relevant politically and is the product of opportunities made, created by insightful and inspired leadership. So, but yes, this is the first nonfiction book that I've written, and I came to write it by growing up. I think the main thing is I grew up in Bernie Sanders, Burlington. Sanders was mayor of Burlington during some very important years in my life and any person's life between the ages of 9 and 17 for 8 years. And of course, those were important years also in the national story because they were the years that Ronald Reagan was in the White House. So the confluence of all these things, you know, my adolescence, Bernie's 4 terms as mayor, the national political scene, it seemed that I had a subject there. My situation was unique, I think, even from other kids who happened to grow up in Burlington under Bernie's, during Bernie's time there, in that, we were a generational Burlington family. I'm French Canadian and Irish. Those are the two main immigrant groups in Burlington. And I was raised really in the old Burlington, primarily in the Catholic Church. Our family is very close to the Catholic Church. So it gave me a certain kind of vantage point on change. In fact, I had a point of view on Burlington and the state of Vermont before Bernie arrived or before Bernie took City Hall. And even though I was young, I was interested and sentient and keeping an eye on it from that particular vantage point. So that's the main thing. I think of myself as an outcome of this strange American experiment called the People's Republic of Burlington, where certain kinds of opportunities were not foreclosed for kids. If you fell in love with the art of poetry and you decided, I'm gonna become a poet and a poetry critic and a poetry professor, there was not just the social and economic discouragement there that would have kept others in other places and at other times from following that same path. So I really think that's why I say there is poetry in the book, because I think the fact that I became a poet is a quite concrete and tangible outcome of interventions that Sanders and his administration and the culture that he fomented in our city, those were the key factors, I think, that allowed me to follow that very unlucrative, long shot path.
This is already all so exciting. So I've gotten obsessed lately with this acronym, which apparently is mostly from the UK, TINA. There is no alternative. And it's a neoliberal slogan, is essentially there's 1 trillion ways to organize human society, and all of them are worse than unfettered capitalism.
Yes.
And if you want to have nice things, if you want to have good businesses, if you want to have poets, you know, you have to have unfettered capitalism. And if unfettered capitalism doesn't let you have poets, that's just too bad. You don't get poets.
Right.
You don't get to say,
yeah,
well, actually, I would like artisanal cheese and poets and no unfettered capitalism. There is no alternative.
Yeah.
In some way, if what you want is different from what the capitalists have given you,
right,
you have failed.
Yes.
Somehow.
Yes. And, you know, I'm a college professor. I see this play out in the lives of my students every single day. You know, they take my poetry workshops as a guilty pleasure. Sometimes, in fact, in a clandestine way. They don't want their parents to know, for example.
It's a secret.
Yeah. And they're brilliantly talented and insightful and inspired, and they're getting to know themselves and the language. And the interval for doing so is closing very rapidly, and they're going to go off and become, you know, analysts on Wall Street. So that's a bummer. I think people who want to be analysts on Wall Street, the way I wanted to be a poet, should be analysts on Wall Street. I just don't think people who want to be poets should be analysts on Wall Street.
It's not clear to me in my time in elite education that there's people who want to be analysts on Wall Street. I mean, this is the irony of, you know, so I really like this writer, the Tina writer, Friedrich Hayek, when he's talking, yes, about all the thing that's wonderful about all of the choices we should have. He really writes poetically, honestly. Mm-hmm. Hayek is like a poet of capitalism.
Yes.
And then he's like, oh, and, you know, but if capitalism can't deliver these choices, then too bad, because, yep, you know, it's like all of a sudden the poetry goes out the way. Hayek throws away his own,
right,
his own poetry.
Right.
And it's the same. I mean, I think it's the same sort of thing in that we would need some sort of, it would be interesting to have some sort of economic system that would,
yes,
that wouldn't encourage people to become Wall Street analysts. Cause my theory is there would be none. I mean, there just would be none. I
don't, yeah,
just, yeah,
we can dream. We can dream. Well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned Mamdani, and the day I spent in New York as a country mouse on election day, I went down to cover just election day. I did have, you know, access to one of the watch parties, not the main one at the in Brooklyn, but mainly I was just walking the streets of Astoria, out on Steinway Street and some other areas. And you saw alternative opportunities for life and thriving all around you, and very much connected to small business and to family business. You pointed out to me, I had not seen it, Corey Robbins' wonderful article about food.
Yeah.
And Mamdani. And I mean, it was not a hard chore to walk the beat, the political beat on election day in Astoria. It was like, you know, is it time for another delicious chicken shawarma? Check the watch. Okay, let's do it. So it was just a kind of a pleasure to be immersed in what I guess we could call Zoran Mamdani's socialism. There are as many, I suspect it's true, there are as many socialisms as there are socialists. But certainly at the core of his vision are little hubs or hives of activity that involve pleasure. Pleasures, plural. Yeah.
I mean, so I've got these, whenever I trot, I have these stock phrases that I trot out that I mentioned that are important to me. And whenever I bring one out, I'm like, oh my God, have I mentioned this on the last 7 podcasts? So I don't know, listeners, if they're so tired of this, but there's this great line that David Graeber has in Utopia Rules. That's like, what was supposedly wrong about the Soviet bloc was that everyone was standing in line.
Yes.
And then they all got the same thing when they were done standing in line.
Yes.
And Graeber's joke is, you know, if you go to the Apple store, or, I mean, I don't know if Chipotle, the fast casual restaurant, existed when he wrote that, but if you go to Chipotle, and I mean, Chipotle is better than McDonald's, but it's, you know, it's a long line, and then you get the exact same burrito.
Yeah.
This goes back to that Tina thing. We're told there's no alternative but capitalism, but it turns out capitalism is standing in long lines and getting a mass produced thing that you don't really want.
Well, right. And Corey Robin quotes Marx talking about how capitalism seems to almost decree universal mediocrity, you know, which certainly we can all attest to that problem. It reminded me, just the piece. I knew the piece was going to take me back to Bernie's Burlington and my memory of it, because that was the last moment anything like this happened. A socialist elected mayor of a city, not a city of 38,000, a city of 8.5 million. So, but I knew that I was going to go back to Burlington because that was the feeling of being on the streets there, of many different kinds of businesses and opportunities and expressions of human life and thriving and creativity. And so I was reminded of a very scaled up version of Burlington when I was out in Astoria.
Yeah, that's just fascinating. And one of the things that's been, you know, rumbling through my mind thinking about this is, you know, what makes it possible for Bernie to become a national figure or international figure is this weird institution that I think most of us really dislike called the United States Senate, which lets a few people, just because they happen to be in one of these strange states that not many people live in, choose one of the 100 or so most powerful people in the world. And there's so many stories of when the people of Wyoming or Idaho or something choose some right-wing nut job, and we just all have to deal with it. And the poor people in New York, you know, they don't have the power that a random Idahoan has.
A Vermonter.
It turns out there's also, Vermont is the only one I can think of. Maine certainly hasn't become a socialist utopia, nor has New Hampshire. There's just one tiny left-wing state that can do this, and it's Vermont. Sorry, I cut you off.
No, please go on. That's the theme of my book. You're anticipating exactly what one of the questions I had going in is, how did such a thing happen? You know, and there are a lot of reasons that we could explore, but one of them is that the counterculture, the arrival of the counterculture, the communes, and so on, in the late 60s and early 70s, once those folks kind of cleaned up and found that they needed medical care, for example, or they couldn't barter for everything, they might actually need to start a bank account, then a very navigable and traversable social and political hierarchy came into view for them, and everything was on the table. So for a lot of those folks, it started by just going to town meeting and becoming invested in committees of town meeting, for example, school committees and so on. And then gradually, perhaps, running for their town's select board, becoming a state legislator. If you're Bernie, becoming mayor of a city, and then, but then eventually finding that you had access, as you say, to the most august and powerful political bodies in our country. So it's quite amazing. I don't think there's any other pocket of countercultural action and organizing in America in the 60s and 70s that offered that navigable path to mainstream electoral political power.
Yeah. I mean, you get people, you know, you get people in throughout the late 19th and early 20th century, maybe you would call municipal socialists. Right. You get someone like Denis Kucinich can be mayor of a blue city.
Yeah.
But then, you know, Kucinich, I mean, we can imagine a scenario in which Kucinich becomes a powerful figure coming out of Vermont.
Yes.
Because, you know, if instead of the mayor of, was he mayor of Cleveland? I didn't prepare my Kucinich stuff. I just thought of it. So
I believe so.
I think it's Cleveland, but Kucinich is not going to become a socialist senator from Ohio. Only Vermont is this possible. So we're filled, you know, I'm in Chapel Hill.
Yep.
Sometimes called, you know, the People's Republic of Chapel Hill, but really it's this tiny town, Carborough to the side of Chapel Hill. That's the real like socialist paradise. But I mean, Carborough is like 10,000 people. people. And let me tell you, the mayor of Carrboro is not about to become the leader of the state of North Carolina. Only in Vermont can this happen. And then I'm convinced, certainly. I mean, it seems, let me just draw this out for people very simply. Sanders revives the brand socialism. He calls himself a democratic socialist, which leads to this organization called the Democratic Socialists of America to expand, although Bernie has never been affiliated with them in any way, is my understanding. It's just, you know,
or same. Any political party or entity per se, you know. I mean, not since the 70s when he was the standard bearer for a left-wing third party called Liberty Union. We can talk about that. But yeah, since then, never. An independent, always.
And now the initial big beneficiary, I mean, beneficiary, maybe not the right word, but the initial figure in the next generation who arises out of this is AOC. And now one of AOC's friends and allies, Mamdani, suddenly, because of this catalyst, I mean, there's all these metaphors like viral or whatever you want to use. Suddenly from this tiny town of Burlington, there's the launching of this national thing, American democratic socialism with a Vermont inflection. And then suddenly, you know, one of the most powerful political entities in the world, New York City, is being run by a socialist. And it's a clear line from this laboratory. Yeah, sorry, go ahead. Say whatever you wish.
No, I'm just agreeing. And both parties leaned in heavily to that analogy. I mean, Sanders was both a close advisor of the campaign and to the transition, and he's going to swear Zoran in tomorrow in the city. But also, I was struck by how thoughtfully put together the analogy between my little city of Burlington and the great megalopolis of New York City, how thoughtfully that analogy was worked out by both parties. You know, whether Bernie knew that he was inspiring the re-energized DSA or not, I suspect he didn't intend to, but you know, the DSA does really point to his 2016 and 2020 presidential campaigns as their kind of founding moment and guiding origin. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess we should also say, for as anyone who's ever listened to him speak, Bernie is a New Yorker.
Oh, like, it's gotten, the Brooklyn has only intensified as he's gotten older. I think he used to, I don't know, make a few nods to Vermont pronunciation, but no longer. Yes. He's a New Yorker, big, brash, urban guy in this quintessential rural state. And he seemed urban even in the only city of any size, Burlington. You know, he seemed a different kind of entity entirely. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned swearing in, so I have to bring this up, and this will make me take us somewhere. But when you're listening to this, listener, this will have already happened, but I just found out that Cornelius Eady has written a poem for Mamdani's inauguration. And I should say I'm embarrassed to admit this. Poetry is not my thing. I'm a little poetry tone deaf, but I do have the people I like, and Cornelius Eady is one of them. So the fact that this goes back to the socialist excellence thing, like this version of socialism really cares about art and beauty and truth. Oscar Wilde, for me, I think Robin in that piece, I think he might mention William Morris and Oscar Wilde, but these people are, you know, the ones who want socialism, not because they want to live in this gray world, but because they want to live in a vibrant world. And it's the infernal factories or whatever. Like, it's actually capitalism.
London. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And boy, there are so many strains that go into Bernie's politics. But maybe just briefly for a moment, going back to the very beginning, growing up in LaGuardia's New York, with LaGuardia so connected to FDR and able to funnel so much federal money into neighborhoods. Of course, there were some very bad things about that, but there were some very good things about it. And Bernie's neighborhood of Midwood, Brooklyn, functioned as this kind of open improvisational space. You know, the kids all had tiny apartments or very small houses. So I interviewed Larry Sanders, Bernie's brother, and he told me about afternoons and evenings on the streets playing. He named maybe 20 different kinds of games involving balls that I'd never heard of, you know. And what I took away from it was that it was a space for improvisation. And anytime you have a space for improvisation, you are not more than a step or two away from art, poetry, dance, puppetry, all of these pursuits that really did flourish in Vermont in the 60s and 70s and kind of concentrated in our city of Burlington under Sanders. So that's one way of sort of backing up Bernie's socialism as far as it could go. And I just wanted to locate the kind of, yeah, the fun and improvisation and pleasure. Perhaps the flip side, dark flip side of that is that things were not so fun in those apartments and not so fun in those little houses. Bernie's parents were barely clinging to working class life, you know, and the precarious, does one say precariousness or precarity? Anyway, both sound bad, but of his parents' economic lives, I think really scarred him. And the street became a kind of green world, like in Shakespeare, you know, like the forest.
I prefer precariousness, although okay. I think precarity is probably.
I'm going to adopt that in honor of you, Graham.
Oh yeah. I'm a real grammarian. So, oh my god. So I want to talk about puppets, but let's hold off on puppets. And I want to talk about LaGuardia, but let's hold off on that now, because one thing I was trying to decide whether to bring up and I didn't put it in our questions is the sex stuff.
Oh,
so,
sure.
Something that, you're unlikely to know unless you are interested in the mid-century. I mean, we're running out of people who lived through the mid-century. So maybe unless you've been reading a lot of stuff in the 40s and 50s, or maybe if you're watching Mad Men, I haven't seen Mad Men for a while, is that one of the big currents of radicalism running through the American mid-century was derived from Freud.
Yes.
And was about the, you know, what became free love in the 60s and the hippie stuff was in fact brought over to the United States by people with PhDs and MDs and suits and glasses.
Yeah.
And Bernie gets his start in radical politics in this from this early intellectual Freud derived sexual liberation angle, which, and I didn't realize this either, the Clinton campaign dug some of that stuff
up. Yes, they did.
if you could understand the irony of trying to paint a follower of Freud as a sex pervert with something they had written in, you know.
Yeah, when you're married to Bill Clinton. Yeah. I hadn't thought of that irony, but that's a very shrewd. Yes. Well, what you say is, I think, perhaps some news that I break in my book. I don't know. Bernie became nationally known when he was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago. When he published an editorial in the school paper called The Maroon, which was decrying gender parietals in the dorms at Chicago. And the language he uses to condemn these rules that say girls have to go home after 10 o'clock is the language of the psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich, who was Freud's disciple and later Freud washed his hands of him. But, you know, it was Reich who coined the term sexual revolution. So this article that Bernard Sanders publishes gets picked up and syndicated across the country. And somebody told me that whenever Bernie would go home, his old uncle would tease him about the sex article that he'd published. But for this blip before he became anybody, long before he became anybody, his name is associated with a kind of libertinism, sexual libertinism. And this is around 1963. And it's very easy to mock. And in fact, I had drafts of this story that were more mocking in tone. But then I read a lot of Reich. And what I found there was that Reich makes the argument that sexual dignity is integral to human happiness, and that it is completely stifled under capitalism. And that one of the material problems is that the working classes in Vienna didn't have enough rooms in their apartments to have a space apart to have intimate life unfold. And so Bernie clearly in 1963 is thinking about the necessity of having a space for private life. And he's also remembering his little apartment in Brooklyn, 3.5 rooms, where his brother and he shared, they didn't have a bedroom. They shared a kind of makeshift space in the hallway. One of them would sleep there, the other would sleep on the couch in the living room. And the parents, of course, had very little privacy. So nobody had, Larry Sanders in an interview with him said to me very solemnly, he said, there was not a space where Bernard and I could decorate, you know, and the necessity that teenagers feel to like put their imprint on the space, whether it's, you know, they weren't allowed to do that or didn't have the opportunity. And the parents obviously didn't have the opportunity to have, you know, an intimate life. So long-winded narrative there, but I think it's essential to seeing what you point out is essential to understanding him. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think when you mentioned, I wanted to bring this up when you mentioned that those apartments were stifling. Well, yeah, that's true, and it makes sense that, you know, we can imagine the lives. I mean, I think from what the key thing in your book is, you know, Bernie's father is in a good capitalist way terrified yeah. of what will happen if he does, you know, in the sort of Hayekian way, he takes risks to try and, you know, right. better himself, because he knows that if those risks don't pay off, unless you've got family wealth or institutional backing, yes. if the risks don't pay off, you can lose what you have. And so to again go back to this green world, this space where there's art and poetry, capitalism flips it. It gets it exactly wrong. It's totally backwards. It says, you know, if you give people economic security, so they have to be afraid that they will not be able to have somewhere to spend the night, or they won't have enough food. Right. Well, then they will run out and innovate and make these exciting sure. things. It's
yeah.
exactly the opposite way. If you know that you're going to have a room to stay in, if you know that you're going to have food and shelter, then you're much more likely to do something fun and different
yeah.
and exciting. Yeah. And sexual liberation, I think to a certain extent with, you know, what's happened over the past 60 years with the sexual revolution, and I mean, I kind of like the term women's liberation. You're not supposed to say it anymore, but what they would have called women's liberation back then, I think we've lost sight of. I mean, this is one of the things we've lost sight of, is how truly mm-hmm. repressive sexuality mm-hmm. was. But then the other thing that I'm, the bigger thing I'm trying to get at, is it's this sense that if you have a community behind you, if you have neighborliness, if you have assurances that you can achieve. I mean, I sometimes, you know, I play a lot of soccer, and if I didn't have health insurance, I don't know if I would
right.
be able to play so much
yeah.
soccer.
Sure.
This floor, it's sometimes called the social safety net, which here's another bugbear of mine. I cannot handle this phrase safety net. Mm-hmm. So a safety net is something you fall into mm-hmm. when you fail and mm-hmm. you're out of the game.
Right.
So something like Medicaid.
It's when you fail at the trapeze, right?
Yes, you know, exactly. Yeah. You fall down. Mm-hmm. So something like Medicaid is a safety net, healthcare for the poor, if someone has been middle class and lost their job and falls into Medicaid. It's a safety net. Something like Medicare is not a safety net. Medicare is a foundation you can build your life on.
Yes.
You know you can go to the doctor. And if you can go to the doctor, you can quit your job and start a small business.
Right.
And capitalism would tell you the goal of that small business would be to turn it into a giant business where other people will have to run franchises for your business everywhere where you sit in a room and you know, talk to Wall Street analysts. Socialism says, well, if you're going to have enough, then just run your bodega for the rest of your life and your kids can get involved in running that bodega, or they can go be poets, and either way, everything is fine.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I say somewhere in my book that I think Bernie, one definition of his socialism, not the ultimate or final, of course it evolved over time, but one definition is that he wanted to make middle class pleasures available to everyone.
Yeah.
And that means making certain kinds of outsized pleasures unavailable to the elite. But it also means introducing things, you know, just very obvious things like well-maintained public parks, nice free beaches, a lot of free concerts, I don't know, there was a kids newspaper in town, there was a teen center. And one surprising thing is you said sort of foundation, the idea that these things could be a foundation on which you could build your life and to have the freedom to express yourself in whatever direction you chose. The teen center in our town in Burlington became quite notorious for actually spawning these kind of horrifically violent hardcore and skate metal bands that by the time I was a teen, I didn't want to go to the teen center because I was worried about getting, you know, a laceration, but it didn't matter because it was a scene that was spawned and supported by not a lot of money, a little bit of money, but mostly just sweat equity by the kids themselves. So yeah, good.
Yeah, I'm struck also, I mean, when you're thinking about some of these outside pleasures, outsized pleasures, not outside pleasures. I'm all for outside pleasures, but these outsized pleasures. I mean, when you think about, I mean, it's simple enough, but I think it's worth saying when people say like, oh, well, where is the money going to come from for these things? It's like, well, have you seen how many yachts there are?
Yeah.
You know, like, have you seen how many yachts there are? There's money out there.
Right.
Obviously, you know, if you've seen all of the, I think they've maybe stopped building them, but when they started building all of those buildings in New York City, the giant skyscrapers.
The skinny ones. Yeah. They all started leaning and falling apart. Yeah.
And that was really no big deal because no one lived in them.
Right.
They were just purchased as investment properties.
That's
and so we're told that there's not money for Red Vienna style housing. And yet it would cost so much less to build housing than it would to build these things for the billionaires. And we're told this is freedom. It's very frustrating. It's enough to make someone a socialist.
Right. And, you know, just to pick up that point, you know, in Burlington, one of the real innovations was Bernie and his administration started a housing trust. Essentially, dilapidated properties would come on the market. City Hall, actually, just to back up a little further than that, a very smart city treasurer named Jonathan Leopold discovered a windfall in the books of about $1 million in 1983 money, which is like $7 million now. And it was used to pay some debts, but also to seed some programs, including a housing trust, where a dilapidated property would come on the market. The city would buy it. The city would then renovate it using programs that they had started for teenagers, for women wanting to reenter the workplace. So there was on-the-job training. And at the end of the day, the property had been fixed up. The city would then sell it. They owned the land, they would sell the dwelling itself. And of course that made the price of the property much more affordable than it would have been on the open market. Upon sale, the profit was capped at 25% above purchase price. Initially, Bernie balked at this idea because in a very middle-class American way, he said, no, home ownership and equity is the key to arriving in the middle class. But he was persuaded that it was a good idea. And over time, some very large percentage of the city's housing was bought up and owned by the city. All of the local banks were eager to write mortgages for folks because essentially the city was a co-signer. So there were a lot of things out there that were socialist, but they were made possible by prudent capitalist moves, you know?
Yeah. And this is really important to me and something that I'm trying to articulate if something is called, in other words, if you want to use the definition of capitalism, this is Marx's definition and in many ways true, which is capitalism means whoever has the money gets to tell everyone else what to do.
Yeah.
Then capitalism is bad. But if Adam Smith's version of capitalism, which is that we should make money flow so that people can do the work they want to do, and we can use money as a bookkeeping tool to see where we are investing society's resources, and we can reward the people who are doing things that people like, but never, Smith is very clear, never reward them so much that they can just sit around and have a giant $1 billion yacht. What the actual existing capitalism bears very little resemblance to, and Smith didn't call it capitalism either. He would have called it free market or something like that. And Smith has all sorts of room for innovations and partnerships, and I dread saying this because, of course, what public-private partnership means in our current version of capitalism is that the state puts up a lot of money and then a rich person takes it. But a public-private partnership, not in that sense. In this other sense, there's nothing wrong with it. In fact, you know, short of the giant capital R revolution, which I think now hopefully everyone knows isn't going to happen. You're going to have something like money. You're going to have something like private property, which you can make more like what Proudhon would call personal property. The place you actually live can be yours in the sense that your hammer is yours, but that those skinny little skyscrapers in New York, that was no one's personal property. No one lived there.
That's right.
You couldn't imagine.
Yeah.
And if this is what socialism means, and I'm convinced it's what socialism should mean, then there's really just about nobody out there against socialism, except for A, the actual billionaire oligarchs, and B, right-wing economists who are constantly explaining to us that we can't have nice things if we have socialism.
Yeah.
I guess now I've kind of spun us back to where we started.
No, but I love it. I just want to add one more thing, which is that, just to flip it a little bit, Bernie's willingness, for example, this was the early days of cable TV, and Burlington had been wired for cable TV and was up to renegotiate the contract. The contract had expired and they needed to do a new contract. And Bernie and an important ally of his named John Franco decided that they would try to municipalize the cable company. And they found the political support. It went to, I believe, a ballot question, and it was very, very large majority approved. And they brought the threat of taking over the cable company, municipalizing the cable company, to the table. And they got the cable company to cut a much better deal.
Yeah.
Because to have socialism at the table, I think, is something that we've forgotten can be such a powerful driving force in and of itself in what might be seen as more of a capitalistic framework or discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, look, the healthcare people knew that because that's why they had to kill the public option.
Right.
Because with socialism as an option, you can have, you know, I mean, look, I think like a lot of people, I learned a lot about how healthcare worked in the first decade of the 20th century while we were having the debate about Obamacare. And, you know, in France and Germany, run healthcare capitalistically within a socialist system.
Yeah.
The UK runs it just, you know, straightforward socially. The government runs everything. And then Canada's a little more socialist, a little less capitalist, but in the same way, it's three different ways of doing it. And I would categorize all of them as socialism. And I'm willing to admit, I mean, this is part of the reason why I fly the anarchist flag. I'm much more amenable to the more what Smith would call capitalism or free market or this Hayekian thing, while also I have to always disavow Hayek because he's so horrible. But the world he describes, I mean, what the way French or German healthcare works is a lot like how Hayek says healthcare would work, except then Hayek would explain that they couldn't do it. He would say, but actually you could never have a system like this functioning. Mm-hmm. But of course it is. We're heading towards the end. I just have to somehow, I have failed in, you know, over 4 years of doing this podcast to talk about giant puppets. Now, as we're speaking, an episode came out today, like 6 hours ago on the Battle of Seattle, where I mentioned giant puppets. And, you know, we have Paper Hand Puppet Company, which I think is based in the People's Republic of Carborough, but does performances in Chapel Hill.
I see.
And one of those guys, I'm pretty sure, it's two guys, I think, lead that organization, and one of them has Vermont roots.
So Bread and Puppet is a great incubator of puppet companies, puppetry companies all across the country. So I would not be surprised if that was his seedbed, this incredible, very much thriving to this day under its founder, Peter Schumann, sort of anti-capitalist puppetry troupe in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont. And yeah, I'm glad you brought them up. A few things. They function as a model society. It is almost entirely bartered on their property. The materials they use to make these enormous puppets are mostly donated or scavenged. You know, old house paint, old timber. You know, houses get torn down and suddenly they become sets at Bread and Puppet. And so both as a model economy, but also as just a ferocious political force and conscience in the state of Vermont, growing up there in the 70s and 80s. And just to tie it quite literally to Bernie's Burlington, you know, Sanders would, you know, one very impressive thing about Sanders is a sort of a different subject, but one impressive thing was that he did not shy away from engaging national and geopolitical questions from his soapbox there in Burlington. And, you know, he would give some impassioned speech about the CIA in Nicaragua and then kind of driving the points home in his way. And then Bread and Puppet would come on and represent this as metaphor, you know? These astonishing, their productions are often set really in the unconscious. And rather than there being, sometimes there's an explicit politics, but usually it's just a kind of dreamed or nightmare version of the headlines. So yeah, they're all over my book. They're a kind of chorus that comes in, like a Greek chorus that comes in throughout the story. Just another example of what, if you set money up properly or successfully eliminate it from the story, you tend to foment this astonishing creative expression. So,
yeah, foment is a great word. I mean, I'm thinking, so we use the word, you know, infection, viral, but better is yeast. I mean, yeah. I think that's Jane Addams' old metaphor is like socialism is this thing that can, you know, set this inert thing that looks dead and set it alight, make it grow, make it make it rise. Yes. And then bread and puppets. I mean, there it is. The bread metaphor goes back to Kropotkin. I mean, bread. Socialists like bread. And yes. I like bread, too. And I bet Vermont is a pretty good place
to get a loaf of bread. Nah, some kinds of bread, you know. Your multi-grains and so on. But
yeah, I actually I've never been to Vermont.
Anytime.
Well, yeah, one of these days, sure, yeah. Sure.
No, but Schumann for bread and puppet, his position has always been that the most important of those two terms is bread. And what he says is that we put on puppet shows to feed people, and that at the end of the show, every show that Bread and Puppet ever puts on, they distribute their wonderful home-baked bread, which was a recipe that Schumann got from his ancestors in Silesia, and a homemade aioli that goes with it. And everyone sits around and eats little pieces of bread. It's like the Eucharist. I'm a Catholic. So it's almost like a sort of Eucharistic moment, but it's quite powerful. And I think, yeah, both as a inspiring social experiment, but also as a concrete entertainment and political conscience, Bread and Puppet is crucial to the story. Yeah.
I just have to mention now very briefly, since I brought up fermentation, something that I wasn't planning on mentioning, but Vermont has also produced the most innovative style of beer. And like Bernie, what is called New England IPA, but should more properly be called Vermont IPA, has just, I mean, when I was in Europe recently, and they said, I was in the UK, and they said, if you order an IPA, it will be a New England, or let's say more properly, Vermont style IPA. Wow. Odds are good. That is so.
So are we thinking of my friends at Fiddlehead and other such breweries?
Yeah, it's a legendary scene. They're mostly pretty small. You mostly can't get them outside of Vermont. You have to get, but everywhere you can get a Vermont style IPA brewed from your local brewery. And a lot of them, a lot of those brewers go up and train in Vermont in this same way with Bread and Puppet, without as much of the political angle.
That's cool. That's very cool. Cheese would be another example.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I think for Prudhomme and for Morris, artisanal production was sort of the heart of socialism.
Yeah.
And again, hard to square with 20th century socialism.
Right.
But that's the kind of socialism I want. Listen, I have to let you go soon, but I have to ask, and I will give you the last word, about Murray Bookchin.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. Sure.
Yeah, so Murray Bookchin he's probably the most influential figure associated with anarchism of the second half of the 20th century. James C. Scott and, of course, David Graeber stand out a lot in the 21st century. Yes. But if people ask, you know, where is the anarchist thinking, you know, is the inspiration for Rojava, it's Murray Bookchin. And I didn't realize that Bookchin was in Vermont.
Talk about
fomenting things.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Bookchin, and his equally important figure is his, by that time, ex-wife, though they remained very close and were allies politically, B. Bookchin, and two very talented kids. One of them is a friend of mine, Debbie Bookchin, who was a very important to this day, extremely important, both steward of her father's legacy, social thinker in her own right, but also during the Sanders years, she was the most important, I would say, newspaper reporter in the state of Vermont. She mostly wrote for the Rutland Herald, but she covered Burlington for the Herald. The Bookchin Sanders rivalry is fascinating, you know. I don't think they could abide one another in some basic way. It was maybe the narcissism of tiny differences, but they, Bookchin supported Bernie in his 81, in his first victory in the city, and got out the vote for him. But from thereafter, really kept an eye on him because he was quite concerned about the centralization of power in City Hall. And one thing that he and others in the city pushed Bernie to do was to create these neighborhood planning assemblies, because my understanding of Bookchin's, anarchism has to do with almost a kind of, I think he called it municipal libertarianism. It's just
something like that.
Face-to-face, direct, hash it out democracy, and the smaller the better. And he found some unlikely allies there. There was a great libertarian thinker at UVM named Frank Bryant, who was really a strict libertarian, but helped Bookchin, I think, work his own version of that body of thought out. But anyway, so they start these little planning assemblies, and right away, Bernie's administration starts to use them as kind of almost just focus groups for what they intend mm-hmm. to do anyway.
Yeah.
And so Murray Bookchin and B. Bookchin were important in putting the brakes on some of that stuff. There was the threat of what would have been, I think, a pretty disastrous development on the waterfront. If you haven't been to Burlington, you don't know, but I highly recommend you visit. It sits on Lake Champlain with a magnificent view of the Adirondack Mountains in New York. So one wonderful thing about growing up there and being there is you have this dramatic sense of the day as it unfolds. The sun rises over the Green Mountains, and then it sets over the Adirondacks. And a developer wanted to block those views. And it was it almost happened. It was the same group that was behind Faneuil Hall in Boston. Yeah. And they were going to do a similar kind of, I don't know, sort of multi-use development. And anyway, the Bookchin stopped it. So that's one concrete thing that Murray and his allies did in the city. But it's a fascinating story because I don't know where you place Murray Bookchin on the political spectrum, but just in terms of eccentricity of thought, there was someone further than Bernie, and that made Bernie seem like an accommodationalist to local capital in some ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, look, for people who haven't been following Bernie's career, Bernie is an accommodationist. I mean, I don't know who would be. I mean, right. Bookchin's a good one. Maybe Ralph Nader is a good example. Like, if Bernie had been Nader, Bernie would have run as an independent in 2016. Right. And so Bernie, and you get this right in your book, Bernie is an institutionalist, even as he is in some ways a libertarian socialist. And Bookchin, I think, is a sort of institutionalist as well, but the institutions are so small that we would hardly recognize them as institutions.
Right.
And for Bernie, you know, I think I would guess Nader is closer to Bookchin than he is to Bernie. And then, I don't know, maybe this makes me a sellout, but you can't argue with the results that Bernie and Mamdani have. Bernie has delivered results practically. Mamdani delivered results politically. Right. We'll see about the practical implications, but
The DSA likes to talk about, and others like to talk about, the left wing of the possible in the country. And I think that is what Bernie represents to many.
Yeah, but you need the Bookchins and the Naders there critiquing, I think. I mean, I'm probably more likely I'm probably more likely to be with them critiquing than I am to be building with Bernie. But that's me.
Well, I don't know whether by custom or by legislation, political debates in Vermont welcome all comers. So some of these are on YouTube and they're worth finding. Every time Bernie would run for Congress or for Senate, he would be up there on a stage with seven or eight other people. And there'd be a stock Republican there and maybe a Democrat and Bernie, and then someone from the Marijuana Party of America, the Liberty Union Party, some party you've never heard of, small government party. So it made Bernie, who was an eccentric in other rooms, seem like the adult in the room. So that was very helpful. Yeah. So I guess the last thing, not the last thing, but one thing I do want to say is that my title, Bernie for Burlington, might seem kind of neutral. It was his campaign slogan, but I mean it to be polemical. I mean that Bernie was for Burlington, and it takes the place to make the person. And so one astonishment in my life is that he has scaled nationally and internationally the way he did, because I think of my city as being so unusual. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that comes through in the book. I mean, here we are. We are at the end, but this that doesn't have to be the last word. Please, anything else you would like to say or add? Go ahead.
Oh, no, thanks. Yeah, that's been so much fun. I'm really not in my depth talking abstractly about politics. This book is almost 600 pages long, and it's just a series of stories. And it's meant to be very entertaining, and it's meant to clip right along. It's meant to have that narrative quality that writers want, which is to have the reader feel swept away. And I guess the last thing I would say is just a plug for the book, which is that it's a book of people and relationships and individual scale change. The challenge in a way was to weave all of that together. And I don't know if I succeeded, but that was the attempt. So
I think, you know, I think it's a lot of fun to read. I recommend it to anyone. I think it works. I think it comes together. You know, I think the Bernie Burlington framing works. And then, you know, one of the things, I mean, look, one of my problems is that I'm too comfortable talking in political abstractions. And I sat down recently to try and write a brief critique of Plato, and I think I wrote 6,000 words and just kept going because abstractions are my stock in trade. There's this old joke, you know, sort of like, sure, we know this works in practice, but we need the philosophers to tell us if it works in theory.
Right.
And as we're having these debates that I am so at home in about abstractions, like the ownership of the means of production, or what is the difference between democratic socialism and social democracy, your book and your, you know, eating through Mom Donnie's Queens is saying this is this abstraction called socialism is in fact a very practical thing worked out in Vermont. And, you know, people say the proof is in the pudding, but the original phrase is the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I'm willing to say that the proof of the socialism is in the cheese and the beer and the bread. We forgot chocolate in terms of Vermont.
Ice cream. I mean,
yes, ice cream. Oh, we left out a couple of very large figures in the Vermont story.
Did. They're in the book.
They are.
Inventing their ice cream in the book.
And so if the proof of the socialism is in the food, is in the excellence, is in the practice.
Yeah.
Anarchy is a practice, and I think socialism is a practice. You wrote the most practical and the most useful of books, Dan.
Oh, thanks, Graham. It's a delight to talk to you. Thanks a lot.